This is the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris, Dan Strauss, Ian Geis. Thank you for listening. And thanks for following me on Twitter at Paul Harris Show. Back on September 9th and 10th, 2001, George Carlin was performing at the MGM Grand Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. He was in residency there, doing several weeks a year at that time. And while he was on stage, he did this routine that no one has heard since.
As usual tonight, I've been doing a lot of complaining, a lot of criticizing, and people seem to like that. I thought maybe by now, you might be ready to hear about something I like. Would you want me to tell you about something I really, really like? Huh? Fatal disasters. Big fatal disasters with lots of dead people. Because I kind of like it when a lot of people die. Some people like macrame. Some people like doing the mambo. Me, I like a nice train wreck. Fire in a paint factory, you know? Going down, plane blowing up, 500 guys trapped in a mine with no air, no water, and one little box of Junior Mints. I like that. It's exciting. To me, anything that kills a lot of people is exciting. You know the best thing I can hear on television? We interrupt this program. You know the worst thing I can hear? No one was hurt. No one's hurt. I get depressed, you know, because I'm always rooting for a really high death toll. That's why I like the natural disasters, the big natural disasters that no one can control. Tornado, hurricane, earthquake. Tornadoes are great because there's hardly any warning, you know, so you can get in there and f***ing nail some people in their sleep. Another nice thing about a tornado, no one can find their cat, which I think is f***ing interesting. Then you got a hurricane. Hurricane is completely different because there's a lot of warning. So unfortunately, you don't get the really nice high fatality numbers. But on the bright side, it lasts a longer time and you do get widespread property damage, which is always a good thing. Another nice thing about a hurricane, sometimes it'll change direction, you know? They come in, they hit one city, boom, hit a f***ing city. Then they lose strength and you get discouraged. So they go back out over the ocean, pick up strength, they come back, boom, nail another f***ing city. So it's kind of like two for the price of one. Weather-wise, it's a good value. Now, earthquakes. You would think with an earthquake, here is a golden opportunity to put up some really big numbers. Fatality-wise, property-wise, it seems like it's a win-win situation all the way around. Trouble with these earthquakes is they never seem to hit downtown in a big city. And they're awfully weak. Have you noticed how weak these earthquakes in America, out in California, these people, they get an 8.5, a 9.7. You know, it's stuff. You know what they need in California? A nice big 29. Yeah. Big powerful 29, yeah. Big city downtown rush hour. 10 years of aftershocks. Aftershocks averaging 18.6. No, 23.5. Give these laid back assholes something to talk about on the beach while they're waiting for the Red Cross to come and pick them up. I like all that. Tidal wave, volcano, monsoon, forest fire, avalanche, a famine, huh? Come on, you can't beat a f***ing famine. First of all, with a famine, you get to see Sally Struthers on television a whole lot more. But the best thing about a famine is it lasts a long time, sometimes more than one generation. So you could wind up with a couple of million dead motherf***ers. You know, to me, you can never have too many dead people. That's why, you know what my favorite disaster would be? And Jesus, I pray for one of these. An asteroid. A big f***ing asteroid. And I mean big. Never mind this shit that destroyed the barn. I'm talking about a big hunk of rock the size of Minnesota. A flaming asteroid the size of Minnesota screaming through the atmosphere and smashing right into... Boom. Hey, Minnesota, huh? What the f***? You can never have too many dead people. And I don't care who gets killed. I don't care who it is. As long as it's not me. Or someone close to me. Although, to tell you the truth, if it's a nice big disaster, something good, the people close to me are on their own. F*** them. It's not my responsibility. And I know what you're thinking. You're saying, well, that's all very cute and clever, George, but you'd feel a whole lot different if one of your loved ones ever got killed. And I think, no, I wouldn't. Not really. Maybe it'd be a little less fun than usual. But as long as a lot of other people died, I'd be fine.
That is George Carlin.
Because I really like big disasters.
George Carlin recorded at the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas September 9th and 10th. They did pretty much the same routine on those 2 days. And that was in prep for an HBO special that was going to be done live that November called I Kinda Like It When a Lot of People Die. But then 9/11 happened the day after, and you don't put out a comedy piece called I Kinda Like It When a Lot of People Die after a lot of people actually did die on 9/11. One of the people who survived both 9/11 and that routine and is a loved one of George Carlin is this woman right here. Her name is Kelly Carlin, George's daughter, who last year came out with a terrific book called A Carlin Home Companion, Growing Up with George, which is going to be out in paperback next month. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys.
Do I have the backstory right there?
You have the backstory beautifully right. Thank you for that. That was well done.
You're welcome. So you and Jerry Hamza, George's longtime manager, decided to release this material. Why now?
Well, it's been 8 years since he's gone, Dad, or as he would want us to say, died. And, you know, we've been searching for things that we thought would be interesting to release. We've got some stuff that's kind of pre-released and we could repackage it and stuff. And then a gentleman named Logan Heftel, who works with us and works with me, he's been archiving all of the audio cassettes my dad saved over the years and digitizing them for us. And he came across these, and this was just, it was such a treasure. It was like, wow, unreleased material. So some of the stuff only the audiences of 2001 heard before he put it on the shelf. And then some of it he reworked into a later show, but it's not the same. So we knew we had something just really rare, like a little gem. And we thought, well, we should honor his title. I kind of like it when a lot of people die, and put this little thing together. And he's going to be he would have been 80 next year, and we thought, well, maybe some people would like to hear some Carlin that hasn't been out yet.
I've heard that routine now 3 times because I listened to the CD when I first got it, and Ian and I had to listen to it so that we could put in the bleeps and all the other stuff in there. And so now I've heard it again on the air, and what hits me every time about it is the specificity of your father's words.
Always, yes.
This man was a word master, and I'm curious about how that worked out, because I love process. Tell me about how he worked out these routines at home and took them on the road, etc.
Well, he talked a bit about this while he was alive, which is great, so we really know it from him. But what he would do is, and what I witnessed most of my life, was he was always writing stuff down on little pieces of paper or speaking into a recorder. Like, the minute he would get a thought, he would write it down because he knows that you're going to forget it. So he wrote everything down, and then he would start to get little pieces of paper that all had one topic. Maybe the topic would be something like natural disasters or death or mass death or something like that. And he would start to get a pile of these thoughts and ideas and maybe facts from the world. And once the pile got big enough, he thought, oh, okay, I've got enough here to do a hunk. That's what he liked to call those bits. So he would do like an 8 to 10 minute hunk, which I consider like almost like an essay. And he would start to string this stuff together on paper. And then he would go out to maybe some local clubs here in LA, or while he was on the road doing places like St. Louis or wherever it was, he would take his papers with him and he'd start to read it out loud and learn it out loud in front of audiences to see what the rhythms are, how it was working, what was getting a laugh, what wasn't, what needed more context and stuff like that, until, anywhere from 12 to 18 months later, he'd have a polished piece, and then he'd put 5 or 6 of those together for his HBO special.
And again, it's that specificity of words, the right rhythm of the words, and having that all memorized and getting it right down. That's what great comedians do.
Yeah, I mean, comedy is really jazz. It's spoken word jazz, and it's part of the human brain, the way the human brain laughs and activates. Laughter is caused by surprise or turning a direction you weren't expecting, and building an audience up for enough tension. And that's a very musical thing to do. And my dad had a great amount of musicality in him. And so he was so good good at that, because not only was it the specific words, but it was the, you know, the rhythm and melody of those words.
There is a lot of anger on this material from 2001 that has been released now on the new album called I Kinda Like It When a Lot of People Die. Was that anger reflected in his home life?
No, no. That anger was his stagecraft and was his public position as an artist. He was outraged by politics, earth, humans, you know, the species. As you guys know, he had a real issue with our species. You know, he knew we had a lot of potential. We still do have a lot of potential. Are we living up to it? No. Full of outrage about that. And so he let that fuel him, and he became our voice of outrage for us, because we don't get around, you know, we don't, not all of us get to go out and talk about these kind of shadow thoughts we have, you know, like, you know, there's a part of all of us that when we hear breaking news and it's a natural disaster, there's a part of us that goes, oh, ooh, I wonder what it's going to be, you know, but we don't let that self out. We don't talk about that. But here he is willing to do that for us. So he's actually, I think, doing a psychological service for people.
Yeah, you know, anybody who denies that is lying, because this is why rubbernecking exists. When there's an accident on the side of the road, you don't slow down just because traffic is slow. You also slow down so you can look over and say, oh, I hope I see a body cut in half.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this is why when there's a huge disaster, CNN is on 24/7.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the other part of that is us looking over there and going, oh, thank God it's not me.
Right.
You know, there's that weird part of us that I survived it. You know, wow, the tsunami didn't come onto my shore, you know. And so there's a little bit of that going on, too.
One of the things that you've included on this new CD of your father's is a thing he did when he was 20 years old in 1957.
Yeah.
It is a rant about cops and firefighters that is, you know, I'll be honest with you, Kelly, it is so inflammatory, there's no way I can play it on the radio today.
Yeah, you know, here's the interesting thing about it, though. If you really listen to what he's talking about, he's talking, okay, first of all, he was 20, it was 1957. Let's give some context to who my father was. My father grew up on the very dangerous streets of the Upper West Side of Manhattan in the 40s and the 50s. He was in Irish Harlem, which was right next to Black Harlem, and, you know, Latin Americans, you know, Puerto Ricans and all of that kind of Spanish Harlem. So he was on the streets. He was an Irish kid. He was not respected by the cops. He and his friends were hassled 24/7, and he watched how cops in the 40s and 50s treated the minorities and the people that he rubbed shoulders with and the people that he really loved and respected. So he had a lot of on-the-street experience with this. Here he is, 20 years old, in a bedroom by himself with a recorder. You know, you can tell he's trying to work out some of these thoughts. These are certainly not things he's going to go on stage and do. He's not even doing stand-up at this time. He's a DJ. And people like Lenny Bruce are his hero at this time, you know, and Lenny's just starting to do this darker material. So, you know, this is a young man trying to find his voice, and also who never had a father and was very much anti-authoritarian. He was kicked out of every single institution that he ever was a part of. So I'm not making an excuse for it. I'm just creating a context for it. And so if you really listen to it, he's a person complaining about the reality of people and what they live with on the streets in New York City, certainly in the 40s and the 50s. And is that a reality for people in 2016 today? Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it is for a big portion of our minority population. This is who they deal with. The firefighters, you know, that's just a throwaway line in it. And the thing he's really talking about is this: how most of these guys are kind of old and fat and couldn't chase after anybody, you know, so why do they have all the authority? So, you know, it is kind of inflammatory, but if you really listen to it, it's really not.
Oh, yes, it is, Kelly.
Okay.
It absolutely is. And it sets the stage for the same George Carlin that we heard in the material from 2001. 1, 2, 3, 4. But what's interesting to me is if you go to the George Carlin material from the 60s and the 70s, whether it's the straight-laced guy wearing a tie on Ed Sullivan or the guy doing Wonderful Wino and the hippy-dippy weatherman on his great albums of the 70s that set the stage for a comedy revolution in this country, that anger isn't present.
So, no, so it's that he, hidden.
Yeah. So it's very interesting to me that this guy had different onstage personalities at different times in his career.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, he knew that if he wanted to become a stand-up and successful, you know, his dream was to be Danny Kaye. You know, his path was become a DJ, become a stand-up, and then become a comedic actor. So he took the mainstream path. You know, he was a DJ. He was a top 40 DJ. When he became a stand-up, he was, you know, the darling of the talk shows of the 1960s and the variety shows. And he knew how to play the game. But it was killing him inside, because inside was that 20-year-old rebel, ultimately. And it wasn't really until the early 90s, the late 80s and the early 90s, that he began to claim this voice of outrage. And if you remember Jammin' in New York, that special, that was really the first time he came out swinging hard and full of outrage at the leaders of our country at that time, and war, and all of this kind of stuff. And he made a big stand on the culture in that show. And he talked about that show as being a turning point for him, and one where he was able to finally claim his full artistic and true voice.
Okay, so how does that George Carlin, that guy who, as you said, had a problem with people and humanity, how does he spend 3 months of the year in Las Vegas?
Oh, it was tough. It was tough for him. He would do about 3 weeks at a time, you know, over the course of a year. But for him, we got him off the airplanes, which are, very, as you know, if you're a traveler, it's very draining to travel. Mm-hmm. He'd been traveling for 50 years already. So it got him off of the airplanes, and it gave him a place where he could write all day and then go downstairs and practice his HBO shows, you know. And the audiences weren't great, you know. A third to a quarter of them would walk out each show because they were so, you know, outraged and couldn't handle it.
They didn't see the sign that said George Carlin?
You know, a lot of them thought they were getting the hippy-dippy weatherman, oh. And some of them really aren't ready for abortion jokes or auto-asphyxiation jokes.
You know what? When you mentioned that, because I had talked to Kelly when I contacted her off the air, and we were talking about him performing downstairs at the Westport Playhouse, mm-hmm. and people were doing that because he set a piece of paper and said, you're not getting my normal material. I've got some new stuff, and here's my notes, and I'm going to go down the list. And it was some of the hateful stuff, and just he was just going off on different things, and people were like, what is going on? And they did get up and leave.
Yep.
Kelly, is there more material that he performed that hasn't been released that you're going to release?
No. There's not a lot there. My dad was very efficient. What he didn't use in one HBO show, he would save for the next one and or one of his books. I mean, those books were full of material that he never got to use on stage because he just didn't want, you know, couldn't do it all.
So he'd go into the files and say, well, here's a routine I didn't do on stage. I'm going to put it in Brain Droppings.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely, exactly.
Well, it's fascinating to me to listen to this with this perspective that you've offered us here today. And let me get the promotion in for it. The album, it's a George Carlin album of stuff you have not heard before, except for the 4.5 minutes we played for you here today. It's called I Kinda Like It When a Lot of People Die, and it does have that 1957 rant, and at the end it has interviews with his manager, Jerry Hamza, and his director, Rocco Urbisi. That stuff is on there, and Kelly Carlin, his daughter, is the one who made sure that this stuff saw the light of day again, and she also wrote the book, A Carlin Home Companion, Growing Up with George, which came out last year, but is coming out in paperback on October 18th, and you can order it online now. I think I got all the plugs in for you, Kelly.
You're a fine human being.
There's a phrase your dad would never have said to me. actually, I did have the honor of talking to him, and it was shortly after your mom's death. He was doing the book tour for Brain Droppings.
Yeah, it was tough.
It was a very, very tough time, but he was a real trooper, and I was always a fan of much of the stuff that he did, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us here today.
And I really appreciate you guys letting me come and join you today and talk to you about this stuff.
Thank you so much. Kelly Carlin here with Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS.